Chapter 11. Invisible Coasts. Cleopatra's nose, had it been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed. Blaise Pascal, Pensée. When Darwin was hobnobbing with pigeon men, it was the power of selection he wanted to hear about, not the power of crossing. I sat one evening in a gin palace in the borough, amongst a set of pigeon fanciers, he writes gleefully to a friend, when it was hinted that Mr. Bolt had crossed his pouters with larger runts to gain size. And if you had seen the solemn, the mysterious, and awful shakes of the head which all the fanciers gave at this scandalous proceeding, you would have recognized how little crossing has had to do with improving breeds. It has often been loosely said that all our races of dogs have been produced by the crossing of a few aboriginal species, he writes in The Origin. But by crossing, we can only get forms in some degree intermediate between their parents. Did the Italian greyhound, bloodhound, bulldog, etc. exist in the wild state? No, of course not. Ergo, he writes, the possibility of making distinct races by crossing has been greatly exaggerated. Darwin was so eager to build a case for natural selection that he may have missed something here. Hybrids may have been more important to most breeders than he thought. At the turn of the last century, the American geneticist Raymond Pearl, adopting a so-show-me attitude, cultivated and quizzed hundreds of breeders just as Darwin had done. Pearl asked bantam breeders, for instance, if they could document a case in which a new bantam line was created solely by selection of small-sized individuals of a large race, variety, or breed of fowls without any crossing in of bantam blood. Pearl got his answer from the world's leading authority on bantams, one J.F. Entwistle. If such can be done, Entwistle wrote, then our 30-odd years of experience of bantam manufacturing counts for very little. We have lived to see the manufacture of some 40 varieties and none without crossing so far. Darwinian selection plays an extremely minor and unimportant part in the process as it is actually performed, Pearl concluded, swinging the other way from Darwin. Today, unlike Pearl, the Grants know that Darwinian selection does work. They have seen it work. Now, as they contemplate the rise of the hybrid finches, they are beginning to suspect that selection and crossing work together as part of the same creative process. There are two kinds of shorelines in the islands, the visible and the invisible. The visible shores are the black broken rocks and white broken waves where volcanoes rise out of the Pacific. They are the borders of the air, the sea, and the lava, wave-gnawed rings around the summits that have given Darwin's finches their homes in the middle of nowhere. These shores are defined simply by the level of the sea. The invisible shores are the borders between the birds themselves. These shores are more intricate. They are defined by the secret codes and unwritten rules that wrap each of the 13 Galapagos finches in a kind of self-invented isolation. These boundaries hold each species apart from the rest, with the interesting exception of the hybrids, so that even though 7 or 8 of them may share the same volcanic summit, feed together in mixed flocks, scrape the same cinders for the same seeds, they still breed as much apart as if they were themselves an archipelago of enchanted islands. Darwin helped to map the visible coasts of rock and coral sand. The Beagle was a surveying ship. But his thoughts about the invisible borders between species were inconsistent and confused. In his first secret notebooks, he described species as isolated by their sexual instincts and equipment. Later, he became so absorbed in his principle of divergence that he neglected this aspect of his subject. What holds the new species apart? What are the barriers and what makes the barriers harder or easier to cross? These are coasts that Darwin left more or less unsurveyed and unexplored. Evolutionists understand now that the isolation of species is not merely a matter of populations locked apart by mountains, canyons, or seas, as Darwin's finches are held loosely apart by the visible shores of the Galapagos. The isolation of species consists chiefly in the invisible barriers that can carve off a corner of a population into a new island, or carve a single large population into a set of scattered, more or less lonely gene pools. It is not just intersterility that produces these invisible shorelines, as between horses and donkeys, nor is it physical or physiological incompatibility, as between elephants and their fleas. Darwin's finches can interbreed and produce fertile young, but something keeps most of them from doing it. The barriers around the birds are invisible because they are created by the creature's own behavior. It is not anatomy, but instinct that holds them apart. To inquire into the origin of species is to inquire into the formation of these instinctive, invisible barriers. Though Darwin himself had trouble with the subject, the secret of the origin of species lies somewhere along these viewless coasts, these shifting shorelines among living things. Clearly, once varieties begin to split off from one another, they need some way to keep themselves apart. Whether they diverge in isolation or partway in isolation and partway in each other's company, at some point they do have to learn to breed with their own kind, their own new kind. Otherwise, a new line would blend with the lines around it and disappear. Darwin was impressed, for instance, by the work it took to maintain fancy lines of pigeons. If breeders crossed their birds carelessly, their creations would soon revert to their starting point, the common rock pigeon. All the pigeon fanciers' whimsical creations, all those pouters, fantails, laughers, and scandaroons, would be lost. What holds these breeds apart and prevents their collapse to the origin is the pigeon fanciers' continual vigilance in arranging crosses. The best of the breeders in Darwin's day, like the famous pigeon man Sir John Sebright, could tell by eye a difference in beak of 1/16 of an inch. Darwin writes, pointedly, that he had to work hard to persuade these exquisitely sensitive pigeon fanciers to make the kinds of crosses that would undo their lines. Such experiments went against the grain, he says, even in the name of science, even for a fee. Darwin had to cajole and wheedle, reminding the breeders that, after all, even ugly birds are still good for the pot. It is Darwin's argument that natural selection can arrange matches too, and better than the best human breeders. The selection process will give living things this gift, this talent, simply by choosing the fittest variants in the nest, the litter, and the seedbed. It will improve their ability to tell one another apart as naturally and inevitably as it improves their ability to eat or to fly. Selection will act this way because those individuals that make bad choices in their mates will suffer a disadvantage. Their offspring will be less likely to prosper in the struggle for existence. Those individuals that make good choices will enjoy a corresponding advantage. Their offspring will prosper. That is why hybrid finches should be rare on Daphne Major. In a population that is diversifying, evolving distinctive adaptations, selection will tend to preserve a new and valuable invention, because individuals in a gradually diverging line will have an adaptive advantage if they choose, as mates, others in the new line. If they choose a mate within the line, they stand to perpetuate the new adaptation. If they do not, they stand to lose the adaptation. They lose the family jewels. So there is selection pressure on creatures like Darwin's finches to learn to discriminate. Those birds that evolve a sexual taste for the new line will do better than those that retain a taste for the old line. In this way, natural selection will ensure that the bird's own powers of discrimination are finer than the pigeon fanciers. It will make birds in the wild, as Darwin put it, their own Sir John Sebright. The power of natural selection will make birds of different lines sexually repugnant at mating time. Darwin saw some evidence of this kind of mutual repugnance even in the pigeon coops. In natural selection, he reports that the dovecot pigeon, the ancestor of all the breeds, seems to have an actual aversion to the several fancy breeds. But when Darwin describes the finches of the Galapagos, probably the earliest colonists, having undergone far more change than the other species, it is the visible, physical isolation of their islands that he stresses, not the finches' invisible, instinctive isolation, which Darwin knew nothing about. Among Darwin's finches, a mating season begins with all the black cocks on the island singing in the rain. Each male broadcasts from his singing post, and while he sings, he scans his territory. If a female alights near one of the display nests that he has built, he darts from his singing post and flies to her. If she is one of his own kind, he sings and shakes his wings at her, makes them quiver tremulously. Then he flies to the nearest nest. Any nest will do, even the nest of a rival, if the rival is out. He goes in and out of the nest, looking back at the female over his shoulder. Sometimes he picks up a bit of grass in his beak and puts it down again, rapidly, over and over, as if he were trying to catch her eye. If the female hops toward him, or at least if she does not hop away, the male begins what the Grant team calls the sex chase, flying after her on a twisting and undulating flight path. He swoops and pivots in midair in what looks to the finch watchers like maneuvers to keep the female on his territory. The female stays just a wing beat ahead of him, making high-pitched cries, "Kew, kew, kew!" These are ground finches, remember. Their wings are short and stubby. They are not really cut out for this kind of aerial acrobatics. The long, twisting flights must require fantastic amounts of energy to keep up, especially after a long dry season of thirst and famine. In other words, the sex chase is expensive. But all the finches do it when they court, young and old alike, even birds that have mated together for years. Loreen Ratcliffe and Peter Grant watched more than 1,000 finches pair off and go chasing each other through the air. In all those courtships, they saw a male go after a female of the wrong species only 26 times. And in the middle of each of those rare cases, either the male broke off the courtship or the female flew away. In 4 of the mismatched courtships, the male stopped flirting and actually attacked the female. Long ago, before Lack, an ornithologist speculated that Darwin's finches might all be one intermingling species, a hybrid swarm, finches just mated with finches. That speculation, Peter Grant calls it a cry of desperation, could only have come from a scientist who had studied the finches in the museum trays and not out on the islands. Since the very first year of their watch, the Grants have known that Darwin's finches have a talent for telling one another apart. The birds' ability to recognize one another is impressive, even a bit mysterious, given the remarkable range of variation in their beaks and bodies and the drab sameness of their plumage. It is true that the 6 species of ground finches look different from the 6 species of tree finches. The tree finches' plumage is a yellowish-green, the general tint of Galapagos trees in leaf, and the ground finches' plumage is black and mottled brown, the general tint of Galapagos lava. They are markedly different birds, even though the tree finches do spend much of their time on the ground, and the ground finches spend much of their time in trees. But there is no obvious difference in plumage among the 6 species of ground finches. There is no obvious difference in their styles of courtship either. The singing post, the flirtations at the display nest, the sex chase, all seem to be the same from species to species. There is no great difference in their territories either. On Daphne Major in Goodyear's, a map of the male finch's turf is a sprawling jumble of intersecting circles and oblongs. A male finch won't let another male finch near its nest, so the epicenters of these territories, their capitals, so to speak, are always separate. And a male scandens will not let another male scandens claim his territory, so their turf is always separate. But the territories of scandens will overlap with the territories of Fortis. On a map, all these territorial borders look like the ripples of raindrops in a pond. In the middle of this overlapping confusion, every Fortis has to find a Fortis. Every Scandens has to find a Scandens. The advertising song that each male broadcasts from his singing post or from his nest is distinctive enough that the Grants and the other finch watchers learn to recognize some individuals by their songs. And this is something birds can do, too. Male hooded warblers can tell their neighbors apart by their songs during the breeding season. Even after an 8-month hiatus, during which the warblers stop singing, migrate to Central America, and then return to their breeding territories, the males still remember and recognize their rivals' songs. Among Darwin's finches, there are usually not one but two or more versions of the advertising song in circulation within each species on each island. Some males sing one version, and some males sing another. On Daphne and Genovesa, a very few birds sing more than one, but the average male has a very limited repertoire. He has just one advertisement for himself, which he sings over and over all his life. The Grants have spent many hours listening to the songs in the islands and studying the song graphs at Princeton. In the graph, the song of one of Daphne's champion breeders, number 2666, is a sort of ghostly pyramid of six gray, fine-lined blotches. Finches number 2663, 2664, and 2665, the siblings of 2666, sang exactly the same song, and so did their father. In fact, most males sing the song of their father. The Grants have recorded the song of 2666 year after year, and the song graphs are all the same. They don't change.
Peter says it sounds like mostly muesli, says Rosemary and laughs. It goes mostly muesli, mostly muesli, mostly muesli.
Another advertisement song on Daphne is more of a choo-choo-choo, she says. Scandens is mainly choo-choo-choo-choo-choo. Rosemary can sing them all aloud as she leafs through the song graphs.
Chi-ai-ai! This one is wiki-picky, 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 very fast.
Besides their advertising songs, all of the finches can also produce a sort of hissing whistle, a very high descending note. All of the ground finches' whistles sound much alike, although on the island of Pinta, the sharp beaks add a distinctive, drawn-out buzz-clink. So it is the advertising song that the Grants have studied most closely as a clue to how it keeps the species apart. Laureen Ratcliffe has discovered subtle variations even in songs that sound alike in the islands and look much alike in the song graphs. These variations are picked up and passed down from father to son. In a series of experiments, she and Peter Grant have taken tapes of some of these songs and broadcast them from a speaker in the center of a finch's territory. More than 9 out of 10 males reacted strongly and aggressively to the broadcasts. They seemed to respond equally to either of their own species' song types, A or B. That is, whether they themselves sing song A or song B, they will fly over the speaker, counter-sing with it, land on it, or stand in front of it and stare at it from close range. They react as if to drive away a strange male who has set up shop and begun to sing in the middle of their territory. Even on islands where two species sing much the same song, a male will respond much more vigorously when it hears one of the songs of its own species coming out of the loudspeaker than when it hears a song of the other species. Laureen and Peter tried these kinds of tests with several different pairs of species of ground finches on several islands, always with the same results. Singing the right song is important. A finch that learns the wrong song is in trouble. The finch watchers have seen, year after year, a cactus finch singing away from his tallest cactus in the prime of health. Year after year, he sings the song of Fortis. He is not getting any younger, a good bird and a good singer doomed to a genetic death. Apparently, every once in a while, instead of learning the song of his own father, a male finch learns the song of a neighbor. Once in a blue moon, he learns the song of a neighbor of the wrong species. None of the finch watchers has ever seen this kind of accident in progress, only the result, full-grown ground finches singing the wrong song. Perhaps, Peter Grant writes, they lost contact as fledglings with their fathers, were fed by a male of another species, and became misimprinted on his song. They may even have acquired the strange song in the nest, Peter believes. There are opportunities. Dolph Schluter says he once had a nest on Pinta in which a female sharp beak and a female small beak each laid 3 eggs. All 6 eggs hatched, and both pairs of parents, the sharp beaks and the small beaks, squabbled over ownership of the nest until the sharp beaks won out. Unfortunately, the 6 chicks were eaten by a hawk before they ever got out of the nest. Laureen Ratcliffe once spotted a small beak, a male, on Española, that was keeping 2 houses a few meters apart. In one cactus, he was nesting with a female of his own species, and in the other, he was feeding the nestlings of a warbler finch.
This is a big controversy in Scandinavia right now, says Trevor Price. A male has 2 nests, Does she know? That's all they talk about in Scandinavia, and it looks like she does know, but that's the best she can do. Misimprinted birds are interesting because they broadcast not one identity but two, writes Peter Grant. A false one at long distance and a true one at short distance. This is one way the finches can get their lines crossed and make hybrids. The misimprinted males tend to get into fights with males that sing their song, that is, with the wrong species. And they tend to breed with the wrong species, too, when they mate at all. Even though his thinking about evolution was formed by what he had seen in the Galapagos, Darwin never quite understood how much species are like islands. The momentum of his long argument sometimes made him sweep past and ignore the distinctiveness of species and talk as if all the categories of life run smoothly together. I look at the term species as one arbitrarily given for the sake of convenience to a set of individuals closely resembling each other, Darwin writes in The Origin, as if species were just as arbitrary a convention as varieties, which are merely less distinct and more fluctuating forms. It is true that the 13 species of Galapagos finches are things of the passing moment, like the bodies of the individual birds that make up each species, like the islands that are their home, and like the very planet that is the home of all these islands. But one of the most significant facts about bodies, islands, and planets is that while they last, they are real, distinct, and separate. True species are as real as bodies, islands, or planets, though what holds them apart is not as uniform or as obvious to the eye. Even now, even with hybrids flourishing triumphantly on Daphne Major, most of the finches on the island seldom interbreed. Clearly, song is part of the finch's secret. But song is not everything. If it were, the cactus finch that sings a Fortis song would be able to mate with a Fortis female, and the broadcasts of the loudspeakers that Laureen and Peter arranged on Daphne and other islands would have had an effect on both male and female finches. The males often attacked the speakers, but the females acted completely uninterested. In almost 500 trials, only 3 females ever came over to the speakers. To find out what was missing for the females, Peter and Laureen set up 2 speakers 10 meters apart on the lava and placed a stuffed male decoy on top of each one. Now the females were more interested. They hopped over to investigate each speaker. They came closer to a male decoy of their own species than a male of another and spent more time near it. They also spent more time with a male from their island than a male from another. Obviously, the females are looking for something more than song. So are males, since when females approach a singing male, the females do not sing. Yet the male decides somehow whether the female is one of his own species, a bird of his feather, worth the trouble and expense of courting. The word species comes from the Latin verb specere, to see. Linnaeus used the word to mean groups of animals and plants that look distinctly different to the eye. After screening each other with songs, Darwin's finches must do their taxonomy as Linnaeus did. They must tell one another apart by eye. To find out what the birds are looking for, Laureen Ratcliffe and Peter Grant performed a slightly ghoulish series of experiments. They collected dead finches from the lava and also a few stuffed specimens from the museum at the Charles Darwin Research Station. They spruced up each corpse a bit and rejuvenated it with a spine of wire so that they could bend the body into various poses. They also painted the beaks of the females dark brown and the beaks of the males black, mating colors. They went to the heart of a male finch's territory right near his nest. There they propped a female Scandens decoy on one cactus pad and a female Fortis on another cactus pad. They tried perching the female decoy in various poses, sometimes in sitting position and sometimes in the much more provocative pose in which the beak is angled upward toward the sky, the wings extended a bit, and the tail spread, an invitation to copulation. In the body language of the finches, this is a powerful invitation. In fact, when Ratcliffe and Grant first bent a model into this shape, male finches began courting it and trying to mount it while the stuffed bird was still in their hands. On Pinta, where the nests were quite high, Laureen would lash the decoys to a bamboo pole and then prop the pole up at the nest. When she carried the pole from territory to territory, males would swoop onto the decoys and try to mate with them. Laureen learned to cover the decoys with a bandana until she had them ready.